Thank you for listening to this message from Flow Church, a church plant in the city of Melbourne, Australia. We pray that this message helps you to experience and express the goodness of God in every sphere and season of life.
Feasting at a time like this. Feasting at a time like this. So we are, as Sam mentioned, we're going to be feasting in a bit, not long. And yeah, I'm pretty excited for some lamb and other things, maybe some carbs. Maybe garlic sauce. This message, this is just the prelude to today's main event, okay? So our main act of worship today is going to be eating a big meal, yeah? And so I want to talk all about that today because, as Sam mentioned, it's Easter Sunday. Yeah, I think he mentioned that today at some point. And he also mentioned we've been doing Lent, and we've been doing that as a church, and that ends today. So let's go to a Bible verse, Matthew chapter 5, verse 6. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. I absolutely love that verse. So I love it so much that Wes, you can just leave that up, leave that verse up there. So we've been doing Lent, this thing called Lent, and if you don't know, Lent is an ancient Christian tradition. It's very ancient; it goes back at least as far back as like the 4th century, I think. And it is this season of fasting. It's this season where Christians have traditionally, they would give up something, usually food. Food is sort of the industry standard of fasting. But, you know, people would fast different things, maybe like entertainment or even not food altogether, but just like a sugar or meat or something. And it is something where it ends, that season of fasting, it ends on Easter Sunday with a big feast and celebration, which is obviously what we're going to do today. But so, and you know, the fasting, by the way, it's, people are not going for like 40 days without any food whatsoever. It's, maybe some people are doing that, I hope not, but traditionally you'd sort of maybe give up either a type of food, or you just only eat dinner, which is, that's what I've been doing the last couple of years. It's what I've been doing this year. And so Christians have done this tradition, right, throughout history, and we've done it to set aside, to kind of carve out a season of lamenting, a season of mourning, and a season of repentance. It's this season of, so this season of lamenting and mourning, repentance, it's about recognizing all the brokenness, the death, the suffering, the injustice, and the sin that's, whether it's out there in the world or in here in our own selves. And we do this to kind of acknowledge that, and we do this as we approach this most central day in the church calendar, right? The day that commemorates the most important event in human history, the death and resurrection of Jesus, by which God has defeated death and brokenness and suffering and injustice. And as we approach this celebratory event every year, celebrating this mighty act of salvation that Jesus achieved for us, in the lead up to that, we slow down. We take time to acknowledge all the things that we needed salvation from, right? All the things that are wrong with the world, such that Jesus needed to come and die and rise again for us. And so we have this intentional season of lament, and we do this season by fasting, right? And so there is this deep ancient wisdom in the church calendar, in the church calendar. So like, as you fast, as people fast, give up food 40 days, and then feast on Resurrection Sunday, people are acting out the drama of the gospel. People are acting out that story of what God has done for the world in his son Jesus, and acting that out in their schedule, right? At the calendar level, in your planning out of your year, you're acting out the story of the gospel. And there is deep wisdom in this, because it's not just a church thing, right? This is a human thing. Your body and your soul remembers what time of year it is, right? There's, you know, so even in the last couple of weeks, autumn suddenly arrived. It was a little late, but it came. The temperature dropped, right? And I am willing to bet that for some of you in that kind of, in that week, some memories got triggered, right? Because, you know, you pass a certain street at a certain time of year, and there's something about the whole atmosphere, the whole scene, just reminds you, oh yeah, it was at this time of year that happened, that I had that experience, that I knew that person or I did that thing, right? That's essentially what nostalgia is, right? It's rhythmic association. So nobody gets this kind of unexplainable sudden urge to watch Home Alone in April, right? That doesn't happen. You know, probably for somebody, but that is primarily a December phenomenon, right? And so we do feel these rhythms, these associations with certain seasons and times of year. And the thing is, these things, they shape us. How we organize our calendar actually shapes us. It shapes our worldview, our thinking, and our feeling. And it can take longer because it's a slow rhythm, right? It can take longer for our recognition of that kind of annual rhythm to emerge because of a very, very slow tempo, right? But, you know, because if you mess with your sleeping rhythms, that's a 24-hour cycle, right? So you'll feel that in the first week. But if you change something about your annual rhythms, it'll take a few years, right, for that slower pattern to kind of become apparent to you, for you to kind of start to feel the effect of, oh, there has been a rhythm over the last few years. But in the long run, that will deeply impact you. Yeah. It's such a deep ancient wisdom in the church calendar of all things. Who would have thought the church calendar would be like interesting and exciting? But it also was not, this was not, you know, church calendar, Lent, this wasn't some cool idea that a bunch of medieval monks had. This type of thinking actually comes from the Bible. Lent itself doesn't directly come from the Bible, but the idea of annual patterns and rhythms comes from God. In the Old Testament, we read how God gives his people all these different festivals. And if you've been at this church a while, you've probably heard Sam talk about this. But like, God gives his people, the ancient Israelites, all these festivals. He straight up tells them, at this time of year, go to this place, eat this, wear this, sing this, say this, smell this, right? And he's shaping his people with this, right? Because God is a master communicator, and he knows that we don't just learn things by hearing. That's not the only way we learn things. We actually learn some things on a profound, deep level when we embody them and when we act them out, right? And so one of the primary ways that God communicates with his people and shapes his people is with the language of food. That's the language. Yeah, now I'm talking people's language. That's the language that the church adopted for Lent, right? Food language. And food language is a universal language. Everybody speaks food. Everybody speaks food. Everybody eats. Everybody likes food. Everybody I want to be friends with likes food. And you know what? Nothing builds anticipation like hunger. You know, there's different kinds of anticipation in life. You know, you might anticipate like the next Marvel movie. Not so much these days. wasn't that long ago that we did anticipate the next Marvel movie. Or you might anticipate a sporting match. You might anticipate your wedding day. Some people here are anticipating their wedding day, I think. But you cannot argue with a hungry stomach. Physical hunger is a type of anticipation that you can't talk or reason your way out of. Your stomach, it's crying out and you can't ignore it. And so fasting by its nature, it builds anticipation. It's an anticipatory activity, right? And so we modern Christians, we like to build anticipation with a social media campaign. Easter's coming or whatever, or the conference is coming. And so, you know, we do our posting and we build hype. But the ancient church, they knew how to build hype. They built anticipation and hype by having a fast, right? And it builds hunger for Easter. You're hungry. You can't wait for Easter to come because you know you're going to eat. You're going to eat properly. You can't wait. But also, the thing is, on this deeper level, you're hungry and it reminds you that you need God's kingdom to come. Yeah. It reminds you that there is an incompleteness in this world. And as you experience physical hunger, it grows your spiritual hunger for resurrection, for God's kingdom to come and bring new creation. And so in other words, fasting is a way for us to hunger and thirst for righteousness. And so I just want to share, a bit of my story of fasting a bit, because I really, really love food. And fasting was not natural to me, right? It's not something I was ever excited about. I went to a Pentecostal church from when I was a teenager, and Pentecostals love to fast, and so I always had friends who were fasting, but I did not get it. I did not see the point. It seemed kind of dumb, to be honest. Okay, I had friends be like, I'm fasting for breakthrough in this area, maybe like the healing of a family member or salvation of a friend or something. And I'd just be like, that's cool. I think I might just ask God for those sorts of things. Like, I don't feel much of a need to also go without food. That just didn't really compute for me. And so I fasted occasionally over the years, to be honest, mostly from peer pressure, because people were doing it. I didn't want to be the only one, like that unholy guy who's not fasting. But eventually, slowly, sometimes out of my own accord, I started to fast because I started to sort of get it. But I never really fasted with conviction, right? I never had this kind of sense of must-ness, like this compulsion that I really must do this. Until at some point in recent years, I don't really remember why or how, but it's just started to occur to me. It started to kind of make sense to me because it occurred to me that fasting is basically like a hunger strike. It's basically a hunger strike, but with God, right? So it's like it's Gandhi. You know, like when you think of hunger strikes, I don't know who you think of. Gandhi was pretty famous for that sort of thing. But do we all know what a hunger strike is? Okay. But so like people across the ages with no spiritual or religious background, right? People across the ages, it's just a thing that humans have done throughout history is petition their governments by refusing to eat until an injustice is rectified, right? I'm not eating until you change this law. I'm not eating until you fix this system or release this prisoner or whatever, right? And people, when they do a hunger strike, they are reflecting in their bodies an ugliness, an incompleteness, an unsatisfaction that they see in some injustice in their society, right? And they're expressing the urgency and the weight with which they care about it. It is as in, this issue that I'm protesting about, this issue is as important to me as the very food that sustains my body. How something is wrong, something is so wrong, how could I eat? How could I eat at a time like this while this is going on? How could I possibly eat at a time like this? That's kind of what this kind of just human phenomenon of a hunger strike is like. And when I saw that, I realized there is this very deep human impulse at play when people will go without food for a cause, right? You're speaking a very human language when you fast, this universal human food language, right? And so for me, this was the way in to understanding fasting. There's a wealth of rich theology in the Bible about fasting, and there's so many aspects to it, but for me, seeing it from this non-spiritual human idea of just the hunger strike, how refusing to eat could be a communicative act, an act of communication, that helped me to make sense of how fasting could have spiritual significance. And so that was, for me personally, a doorway into fasting out of conviction and not peer pressure. So like, does anyone watch Curb Your Enthusiasm? One person, two people. Okay, it's a sitcom. Larry David, creator of Seinfeld, which is the best sitcom of all time. He did his own sitcom, and basically he just plays this terrible guy who gets into just awful situations, and it's a yeah. But so. There's this episode in Curb Your Enthusiasm where Larry, the main character, he's done something that offends somebody, and his friends convince him that he has to call and apologize to this person, right? And so he calls up this guy that he's offended, and he calls him to apologize, and so he's apologizing, but while he's apologizing, he's eating pistachio nuts, and he's like, yeah, I just want to say I'm really sorry. And like the guy on the other end of the phone, he can hear that Larry is eating. And he's like, are you eating? Like, are you snacking on something? And basically the guy will not accept the apology because he says, you can't eat while apologizing. You can't actually be sincerely apologizing and eating at the same time. It just doesn't. Those things just don't go. You can't be kind of acknowledging, you can't be just like acknowledging that something is wrong while also eating. Those things are kind of, they're just opposites, right? Another example from my own life is I had a friend, it was years ago, and went through a breakup with her boyfriend, and I didn't know about this yet. We were at this house party, and she like pulled me aside. She's like, can I talk to you? She was about to tell me that, you know, her boyfriend broke up with her, and I'm like, cool, you know, we walk into another room to talk, and she just comes out with it. She's like, my boyfriend broke up with me, but the thing was that it was a party, and I had a bowl of food in my hand. At the exact moment that she said that she told me that her boyfriend was broken, I had just like shoveled like a big mouthful of food into my mouth, and so I was just like, oh no, I'm so sorry, and I felt so terrible that I had food in my mouth when she told me that. I think, I'm pretty sure I actually had to message her the next day and say, I'm so sorry that I had food in my mouth when you told me that. Because there is just something about eating that doesn't go with mourning. Like, you can't be mourning, you can't be like contemplating what something's that's really wrong and also eating. They just don't, it's just not congruent. And so the thing about fasting, I promise I'll be talking about Easter sometime soon, talking a lot about fasting. But the thing about fasting is that fasting helps you mourn with those who mourn. We fast because the world is hungry.
Yeah.
The world is hungry for God, whether they know it or not, hungry for God, hungry for justice, hungry for peace, hungry for reconciliation, hungry for relationship, for rest, and for a lot of people, hungry for breakfast. And by fasting, we identify ourselves with the hungry, the poor, the humble of this world, those who mourn, those who lack. Right, we express the solidarity of that in our bodies. We let their experience be our experience, and this process actually grows our heart for the poor and the afflicted. And so when we fast, it's like we're carrying the poor and hungry with us everywhere we go, because we can't forget about them because we're hungry, right? We're reminded of their reality, their experience, and it becomes our reality and our experience. And then we cry out to God with our hungry body. Our stomach cries out and says, God, come and make it better.
Yeah.
Come and make it better. And in so doing, we more fully hunger and thirst for righteousness. We can actually put that Bible verse back up. I'm not done with it. When we fast, we more fully hunger and thirst for righteousness. And I don't know what you think of when you think of the word righteousness. It might sound like just a very religious word to you. But in this context, this is something, not everybody agrees about this, but it seems very clear to me that when Jesus said the word righteousness here, it seems very clear. He was talking about the Hebrew concept of righteousness, which is all about the harmony and right ordering of the world, for things to be put right,
yeah.
Right? You could translate it as justice, and that would be pretty reasonable. So you're saying, you know, when you hunger and thirst for righteousness, you're saying, God, come and fix it. Come and heal. Come and restore. Come and bring new life. Please, God, come. And so for me this year, as I've been fasting for Lent, as I mentioned, I've just been only eating dinner, right? And so the days can get pretty hungry. And so when I have felt hungry this past 40 days or so, and when I felt tempted to eat during a long day, the words that have kept coming back to me, which have almost been a bit of a mantra, these words have just been, but how could I eat? How could I eat? Right? How could I eat at a time like this when there is so much brokenness, so many hungry people? How could I afford myself such peace and satisfaction in my body when there is so much unpeace and desperation in the world? And about just a week and a half ago, I was pondering this. And I was pondering this as I knew Lent was coming to an end and Easter was coming. And for a moment, I almost couldn't even see how I could ever stop fasting. Like, I almost felt like it would be wrong to ever finish this fast, because as long as there are still things in the world that are not right, how could I ever eat again, almost, you know? And it was just like I couldn't see an end to it. Because yes, Easter will arrive and we'll celebrate Jesus' death and resurrection, but the problems in the world won't have suddenly gone away, right? Like, they didn't suddenly go away when Jesus was resurrected 2,000 years ago. They didn't suddenly go away. And until Jesus actually returns, you know, all the war, the violence, injustice, sickness, loneliness, all of this stuff that's in the world, it'll still be here. And so how could I eat at a time like this? Even though Easter's here, how could I? And I really kind of felt Jesus sort of sort of appear to me and put out his hand and say, and it's like he said to me, take, eat, this is my body, broken for you. Take, drink, this is my blood, shed for you. It's time now to eat, right? Because it's time to trust that Jesus is like, it's time to trust that I will feed the world. It's time to trust in my abundance. This, and this is kind of his word to me, and maybe this is God's word for some of you this Easter as well. Is that God's saying, I'm proud of you, child, for taking these things to heart, for caring about the needy and the afflicted, for desiring my kingdom and my will to be done, and for letting your heart and your values and your prayers be shaped according to God's heart. But now is the time to trust that I care even more, that God cares even more. I've got this and I'm coming soon. At the right time, I will come and renew it all. So, theologically, one of my favorite things about Lent is that we don't fast on Sundays. We do not fast on Sundays. Throughout the Lent season, we break our fast every Sunday. You don't fast on Sunday. You never fast on a Sunday. And why is that? Because the bridegroom is here. Because we're in the presence of Jesus. And you don't fast in the presence of Jesus. So let's go with to Mark chapter 2. So John's disciples, that's John the Baptist, his disciples and the Pharisees, they were fasting. Some people came and asked Jesus, how is it that John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees are fasting, but yours are not? Jesus answered, how can the guests of the bridegroom fast while he is with them? They cannot, so long as they have him with them. But the time will come when the bridegroom will be taken from them, and on that day they will fast. When Jesus was here, he was like, how could my disciples fast? I'm here, guys. Like, it doesn't make any sense. I'm here. You know, everything that you are crying out for in your fasting is present in me. So feast your eyes on me. I'm here. It's not a time to fast. And so in Lent, we would traditionally honor the presence of Jesus on a Sunday by suspending our fast. And so then when it comes to Easter Sunday, Resurrection Sunday, it's the Sunday of Sundays, right? It's the Sunday that made Sunday what it is. It's the Sunday when we celebrate Jesus' presence, but on a whole other level of presence, right? His incorruptible, indestructible resurrection presence. His victorious, death-defying, death-defeating presence. New creation birthing presence. And his resurrection body containing the beginnings of God's new creation. I might get the band to come up. But so, if Jesus is the groom, where's the wedding? And when's the wedding? It's at the end of the world. Yeah? So if we go to the end of the Bible, which talks about the end of the world, Revelation 21. Have we got that? Oh, yeah, it's like the last slide. We've got to skip a few, Wes. There we are. I'm going to turn around for this one. So this is the Apostle John's vision. And he says, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. So the bride is the New Jerusalem, and the New Jerusalem is the church. It's the people of God. So we're the bride. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away." He who was seated on the throne said, "I am making everything new." Then he said, "Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true." He said to me, "It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty, I will give water without cost from the spring of the water of life. Those who are victorious will inherit all this, and will be, and I will be their God, and they will be my children." So this, the Bible portrays the end of the world as this wedding feast, right? You see, there's a wedding, and then there's, well, in this case, water. But there's definitely a feast going on. And it's just amazing to me that, you know, the phrase, the end of the world, like that's for most people, probably not a very nice phrase. It's probably got a pretty negative connotation for people. The end of the world sounds like a cataclysmic destruction, right? But according to the worldview of the Bible, the end of the world is a big wedding feast. The end of the world is not a destruction. It's a new creation. And the ultimate destiny of the universe is not calamity. All of history is leading not to destruction, but to celebration, to new life, to new creation. The beginning of a new history, a better history. And so here's my point. While Jesus was with his disciples, they couldn't possibly fast. It just wouldn't make any sense. How could they fast? He's there. The bridegroom's with them. But now, Jesus is not with us in body. He's with us in spirit. His spirit is here. But his body, he's not with us in his body. And he's coming again one day to establish justice and righteousness, to put the world right. He's coming one day to do that, but not yet. It hasn't happened yet. I mean, it could happen in any second, but assuming it doesn't. And so while Jesus is away, we can fast. It's okay. We're allowed to fast. Jesus will allow it for now, right? There will be times in the Christian life for fasting and lamenting and mourning with those who mourn. But Christians also need to be people of feasting. People whose life is marked and characterized by rejoicing and celebration. Because that is the ultimate reality of the world. Like, because here's the thing, fasting testifies to the present reality that everything is not as it should be. That's what fasting does. But feasting testifies to the future. Yeah. Feasting testifies to the future that God will come and heal the world. Yeah. And he will end all suffering and wipe away every tear. When we feast, we are telling the future. Right? And so, you know, in a few minutes, we're going to go out here, there, and we're going to eat some really good food, I think. And I'm sure souvlaki is exciting enough for most of us. But if you ever needed a pep talk for eating lunch, here you go. Here's one. Because we need to know, if we're Christians, we need to know that as we eat, we are prophesying. We are proclaiming, blessed, we're saying it, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness and justice, for they will be filled. We're prophesying that, right? We must be people of feasting. Because in eating, we're testifying of the great wedding banquet that is coming to a hungry world. And we're testifying that God is the God who gives to the thirsty water from the spring of life without price. That's the kind of God he is. And that's what we're testifying to when we feast. We feast because the sufferings of this world are not worth comparing to the glory that is to be revealed to us. We feast because we have food that the world does not know about, and the world needs to know about it. And we feast, as we feast, we proclaim that Jesus' body was given for us, and it is an oversupply of provision and grace, and we trust that we have more than enough, and that there is always room for the hungry at our dining table, and we are always inviting people in. And today of all days, we feast to celebrate the resurrected presence of our bridegroom who defeated death. And his resurrection carries a promise of new resurrection life to all who accept it. And so I hope you're hungry. I hope you're hungry, because we have a lot to eat about. Yeah? Amen. We're going to eat. And so, but before that, let's praise the name of the Lord our God.
Thank you for listening to this message from Flow Church. For updates and information, head to flowchurch.co or follow us on Instagram @flowchurchmelb.